This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. This week, Florida's Education Commissioner Richard Corcoran released an executive order telling schools they'll have to open up brick-and-mortar campuses 5 days a week in fall. School districts are now trying to figure out how to reopen schools safely as the coronavirus pandemic continues to surge statewide. Teachers are worried about the health of their students and themselves once campuses reopen. I reached out to Elizabeth Albert, president of Volusia United Educators, a union representing teachers in Volusia County. She says the executive order came as a shock.
I will not speak for the district, but I will speak on behalf of our organization, and we represent almost 3,800 of the instructional and support members in this district. So we are very disappointed in the executive order that was released on Monday. We are shocked and saddened to think that the governor and the commissioner feel that they can control and dictate what is done within Volusia County schools. You know, our school board members, and we have five of them, are constitutional officers who are tasked with making the decisions for the educational professionals and students in Volusia County Schools. So we feel that it is an extreme example of overreach on the part of the governor and the commissioner.
Like, from the teacher's perspective, what kind of protocols are going to be in place, you know, when they do go back to class, as far as you know?
So Volusia County has not articulated their plan. They have not released their plan yet to the public. They are set to do that next week on July 15th, and they're having a special board meeting to share that information. We've surveyed our members, and we have some members who are ready to go back brick and mortar. We have other members that are highly concerned about returning to schools based on what they're seeing in our state and in our communities about the rise in the cases of COVID. So we are just hoping that whatever plan is presented affords a variety of options, not only for the educational professionals, but for parents as well.
One of the things I've heard from some folks is that there's kind of a psychological element to getting back into class too, right? I mean, there's the physical health and safety, but I think there are some people who are also worried about social isolation and things like that. So is it a bit of a balancing act, do you think?
Well, I think that there is certainly... I know that when we do reconvene, whenever that day comes, we are definitely going to need to provide social and emotional support to our students and to our adults. I believe that this whole COVID situation is actually a traumatic experience for many of our folks, but returning to school to meet the social and emotional needs and the socialization needs of children, at what cost do we do that? Right? Do we return at the cost of their health and safety? I think not. I think we've proven during this time that there are unique and out-of-the-box ways to remain engaged with each other. Nothing beats a good run of the jungle gym at recess, I'll tell you that. But right now, we really can't do that, and we need to be flexible.
Just kind of looking back over the last part of last semester, how did that go for teachers? Because I know it was a bit of a steep learning curve for a lot of folks figuring out how to do online learning. Some people, it's their first go-round at doing that, right? So how was that for your members?
Well, I'll tell you that our members, they have shown once again how well they can spin on a dime and how they are just head and shoulders above, and they go above and beyond for their students. We had a very short turnaround time that we were afforded to move into a distance learning capacity. And it was rough at first, you're right, but I think that eventually we got our groove and we were able to maneuver the best we could. Do I think that it was, the best situation? Probably not. Do I think that there are some gaps that are going to need to be filled? Absolutely. But I think that in order to be able to do that work and do it well, we need to minimize the other risks, and we shouldn't have people returning to an environment where they're constantly worried or they're filled with stress and anxiety or fear even. You can't teach in that kind of environment, and students really can't learn if they're anxious or stressed out. So we want to make sure that when we're trying to fill those gaps and we're trying to deliver the highest quality academic content, that it's in an appropriate environment.
What do you think the best outcome would be in the next few weeks looking ahead to the next semester? Like, what would you hope to hear from both, you know, folks at the county level, but also at the state level?
Well, without a crystal ball, you know, I don't know exactly what's going to happen. But the best thing, I mean, you know, we're all praying for a reduction in the cases of COVID. You know, the ultimate win would be if this thing were to go away, or a vaccine was to be safely developed and we could all just move past this. But we don't really think that's reasonable expectation. So I think that the governor should allow school districts to serve the populations that have elected them to be their representatives. I think that every district in our state, all 67 of them, are different from each other. And so we should be afforded the opportunity to create plans that work for our adults, our students, and our communities. And so at the state level, I would like to see them back off. And at the district level, I would just like to see a variety of options that would afford parents who are at different places in all of this the ability to have their children educated through the public school system in a way that is safe and equitable.
Thanks so much for your time, Elizabeth. Appreciate it.
You're very welcome. You have a great afternoon.
Elizabeth Albert is the president of Volusia United Educators, representing some 3,800 teachers and support staff in Volusia County. Turning now to police reform. On Monday, Orlando Rolon, the Orlando police chief, told the city council that the police department would ban chokeholds and no-knock warrants. It's part of a range of reforms activists have been calling for amid protests sparked by the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis police custody in May. I spoke to Rolon about reforming the police department. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Matthew.
So the meeting this week with the city council and the decision to make a couple of policy changes, that's kind of a big deal in the world of policing, right? Banning chokeholds and also no-knock warrants. Just talk us through the thought process behind deciding to make that call.
So, Matthew, I think it's important to recognize also that, like, for example, the chokehold, it was already part of our training and part of our policy that we do not teach that, that we don't practice that. So that was an easy one. The importance of that process was to make sure that it was clearly defined in policy. So that was done. The no-knock warrants, I think that one was much more subjected to debate among the members of the profession. But what I, you know, of course, Mayor Dyer has led this process, and he asked that we look at everything that has been recommended. And in that one particular area, I also was of the opinion that, you know what, it is good to also keep this in play just because the situations sometimes come up that require for you to go in stealthily into a situation. But what I learned during this process is that many could not remember the last time we actually petitioned for a no-knock warrant, meaning it's something that has not risen to the level where there has been a significant need. So again, it became a very easy decision to take the stance and take the approach that that is not something that we need in order to do business moving forward here at the Orlando Police Department.
There was some pushback in the meeting on Monday, right? I mean, you had Commissioner Tony Ortiz. He's a former OPD officer himself. He said it could put officers at risk. So what is the feeling among police officers about this? Do they think this is going to put them at risk?
So in part, it is a concern for some when you have a situation that rises to the level where this particular practice would be could be implemented to protect the officers going in to a high liability situation where an individual could be armed and there's a high potential for the individual to affect the officers going in. But I think we have to then step back and take a look at the whole situation and then ask, how often is this being exercised? And it is rare for us here at the Orlando Police Department. It is rare that we have a need to actually petition for that type of warrant, meaning every warrant that we have obtained has not included a no-knock clause, meaning we've been able to do what we intended to do, which is to target a location that is practicing something that may be illegal and we have not had the need to do so without announcing that we're there first.
What are some of the other things that the police department is looking at, or that you are looking at in terms of changing some policies?
So many people are familiar with the 8 can't wait recommendations. We found also that here at the Orlando Police Department, we've been practicing many of those recommendations, if not all, through training or in policy for many years. But here recently, we had an incident that occurred a year ago, an incident that where one of our officers was dealing with an individual who had been resisting, and the knee, in order to control the individual, was on the individual's shoulder. At one point, the knee, you can see the knee is closer to the neck, if not over the neck, while the individual's on the ground. It never restricted the individual from being able to breathe or being able to move their heads or be able to communicate. But obviously, when you look at the video, you see the knee near the neck. And after Mr. Floyd's death, it is a concern. So we went a step further. Not only did we look at that situation as far as what was depicted on the video, but we said, what led to that situation? And it was a seatbelt violation that led to the confrontation that took place at the home that led to a couple of individuals being arrested, all within the legalities of the law. But do we need to be stopping people for seatbelt violations? I think that was a teaching moment, a moment that will allow for us to reflect on things that by law we may be authorized to do, but what are the community's expectations? Does the community expect us to enforce no seatbelt violations as a primary offense? Or does our community expect us to disregard those and focus on other areas? And I think you will find that no matter what, moving forward, there's going to be some individual who says, but I think seatbelt violations are important. I think that, you know, me personally, a person may say, I lost a loved one as a result of them not wearing a seatbelt. I would want you to enforce no seatbelt violations as much as possible. So somehow we're going to have to manage the expectations of our citizens and how we exercise those expectations across the board, not just in specific areas of our city.
But are you not getting some pushback from your officers, Chief Rolon? Because I could imagine there might be some who are saying, well, look, we need the flexibility to say if we feel the need to, you know, investigate somebody, we should have the discretion to do that, you know, whether it's a seatbelt violation or whatever it may be.
And Matthew, I'm not saying that we're not getting pushback. There is a lot of concern right now among the members of the law enforcement profession. When it comes to some of the recommendations and some of the implementations that are being made when it comes to policy and the way we do business, the key is going to be us maintaining communication, not only with our citizens as leaders, but also with our troops, with our officers that are performing the task out there, with the officers who are really the front line that is in the most danger or the most concern for potentially getting hurt as a result of those decisions. So there's always going to have to be a balance, but history has shown and history has proven that the way we do business has been modified, you know, decade after decade and since the history of law enforcement being implemented. This is one of those times in history where we have to look at the way we do business. But most important, I think responsibility also should be placed on the citizens that we serve and for them to set what those expectations should look like. Because it's one thing for the police department to say, this is how we're going to police you. It's another for the community to say, this is how we expect the law enforcement profession to police our neighborhoods and police our communities. And then I think we also have to define a better way to evaluate whether a law enforcement entity is performing those tasks to the satisfaction of the citizens they serve. But again, I think the citizens should set those expectations and make those expectations clear to the law enforcement profession, whether it's, you know what, we believe you should make one arrest a year versus 10,000 arrests a year. We believe you should arrest people who injure someone or fire a weapon, you know, against a house or a car or an individual, or you should arrest them all. You know, I think we're going to need some better guidelines from our citizens on what those expectations should look like moving forward.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Orlando Police Chief Orlando Rolon. We're talking about the changes to policy that the police department is rolling out. So how would that work? Would you, how are you going to get that feedback from the people of Orlando?
I would pose a question to you. How do you think, Matthew, as a citizen of this community, how would you what would that look like to you? So for us, we do our best to try to judge how our community would want our officers to perform their duties. We know we must be professional. We know that we must provide adequate training to the members of our agency. We know, in our case, that we want to exceed the amount of training that is required in order for them to maintain their certification. But when it comes to seatbelt violations, is it something that we should just completely eliminate, or is it something that we should, you know, potentially only practice during a certain period of the year when awareness is being raised about the importance of wearing seatbelts? The number of officers in a given neighborhood. Right now, we base a lot of our, or we allocate our resources depending on where the crime activity is taking place. So some areas may have a larger presence of officers than others. I'll give you an example. Shootings across the country are at an all-time high, or much higher than we have seen in recent years. We're experiencing something similar here in the city of Orlando, but we're experiencing that in specific areas of the city. So when we utilize our resources or move our resources to those areas to target an increase in shootings, one conduit that leads us to recovering or finding illegal guns are vehicle stops. Within the guidelines of state law that allows us to make vehicle stops, we do the stops and often we'll find a weapon that is illegal or not properly owned or possessed by an individual, and an opportunity to remove a gun off the streets. So moving forward, I think, and my goal is going to be to engage members of the community, to explain a similar scenario like the one I just shared with you, and say, what would you prefer we do when we see a spike in activity in your given area? Would you rather us let it die on its own, or would you rather us go in with enforcement action? So I think that's the type of difficult discussion we're going to have moving forward.
Is it fair to kind of simplify it that much, though? Because I think, you know, a lot of what you'll hear from activists is like, they're not saying they want less policing. They're saying they want, you know, accountability. And when it comes to, you know, certain officers who don't play by the book or don't do things right, I think some of the concern from activists is that, you know, when that happens, they don't think there's enough of a sanction on them. They think those officers, you know, there should really be stricter penalties for them. They should, you know, maybe take a hard look, or the police department should take a hard look at whether those officers should actually be, you know, on the police department or not. And so I'm wondering, you know, moving forward, what kind of thoughts do you have about making sure that officers who do cross the line are held accountable for it?
So we have to be very transparent about the way we do business. We take officer involved shootings, for example. You have an outside entity, third parties that come in to basically evaluate our shootings. We then put all that information out on our webpage for all officer involved shootings, to include the racial makeup of the officer, the individual involved, the outcome of the investigation, what the specifics of what led to the investigation. I think we need to do a better job of educating our citizens on how our investigative process takes place, and to be very transparent by that I mean to also inform them that they have every right to look over every single investigation that we do, so they can read the investigative findings for themselves. So we have to make sure that we hold our officers accountable. I think the goal for a law enforcement entity is to also demonstrate that not only are we holding our officers accountable for their actions and is meeting the citizens' expectations, but we also need to educate our citizens on the rest of the work that is being done that is not questioned, that is honorable work, that is great work that is being done in any given community where a law enforcement agency has jurisdiction. The city of Orlando, for example, over 500,000 contacts with citizens that we can track in our system on any given year, right? How many uses or response to resistant uses of force do we work on average? It has been declining year after year. Right now, we're averaging about 450 or so. And where are the majority of those response to resistance occurring? They're occurring in the downtown area where the bar district is from Friday to Sunday. A lot of people don't realize that. Sometimes if you hear about an officer use of force and one that is not proper, that gets a lot of attention, and rightly so. That gets a lot of attention. But I think we need to also do a better job of educating our citizens on the great work that is being done each day that is overwhelmingly more positive than the negative stuff that often gets the most attention. But you're right, Matthew. I think we need to do a better job of ensuring that our citizens understand that when our officers do wrong, that we are doing our part to make sure that proper discipline is being rendered when someone does wrong.
So just so I'm clear on that, you're saying that you think the Orlando Police Department does do a good job of holding officers accountable, but you just think that maybe the public isn't aware of it?
In part. And also remember that the rules that we that we're governed by, whether it's once you have an incident that happens and an officer is found to be in violation of the investigation, right, that was conducted, we have discipline standards that we must apply. And we cannot deviate. We used to be in a position where we couldn't deviate a lot from past practice. So, for example, if someone was involved in a car accident, or if someone is involved in a car accident is the first time, depending on the significance of the crash, a dent on the door, that may be an oral reprimand. The officer gets involved in another crash, you know what? Now you have a written reprimand. Gets involved in another crash, now you have hours being taken from you as a penalty for your actions. And then if it elevates from there, you know what? Maybe this person is not suited to drive a vehicle anymore, and maybe they're not suited to be an officer because of that. So depending on the situations, there are levels of discipline that due to past practice we render. Where it gets very complicated sometimes is when it comes to a use of force, right? Depending on the totality of the circumstances and the actions of the officer, it allows you to then determine exactly what type of, not exactly, but it allows you to best apply discipline moving forward. I think that's the part that we're going to have to do a much better job of explaining to our citizens, especially our Citizens Review Board, where we explain these cases. I think we're going to have to do a better job of saying this is what's this is why this issue is a little more complicated than most people think.
And Citizens Review Boards, I mean, I spoke to the vice chair of the Orlando Police Citizens Review Board last week, Kyla Coleman. She said she wants the review board to have more influence, or at least a bigger, you know, more of a seat at the table when it comes to shaping policy and influence on, you know, how disciplinary action is carried out. So are there thoughts from your point of view, Chief Rolland, on how that might change going forward, the influence or the impact that the Citizens Police Review Board may have?
So our Citizens Review Board has been in place since 1992. We are one of the first Citizens Review Board models that was implemented here in Central Florida. It is probably the one that everyone looks at as, you know what, if you're going to have one, this is what it should look like for you if you're going to start one. Where, Matthew, I think it gets complicated when it comes to Citizens Review Board is their ability to what extent should they have an authority or an ability to deviate from or say you need to change this finding, right? Mm-hmm. They make recommendations, and we don't take those recommendations lightly. Our police department, the reason why we have FDLE and a third party do our investigation was because the Citizens Review Board made a recommendation you shouldn't investigate your own. The reason why our social media policy was changed and now has very strong language that could ultimately result in someone being terminated if, depending on the type of posting that they do on their social media, was because of our Citizens Review Board. The reason why our officers, junior officers, are not allowed until they become permanent officers to work alcohol establishments is because our Citizens Review Board made that recommendation. So we have always listened to the Citizens Review Board. Now, if a situation like the one dealing with our social media, where the Citizens Review Board recommended that the officer be terminated and to say, well, they should have enough power to terminate an individual, I think that's where the line is drawn, because unfortunately, even through an arbitration process, we knew that that type of case maybe would not rise to the level where an arbitrator would agree to terminate an individual. And that's what makes it tough. When you have a volunteer, and God bless them for volunteering for that work, and they come in once a month or once a quarter, depending on how the meetings are held, and they're having to keep up with the responsibilities of their job, they're having to keep up with the responsibilities of their private lives, you have to immerse yourself into a setting to have the most knowledge to be able to say, I am prepared to deviate from what you're telling me or you're recommending. So moving forward, I think changes are coming for Citizens Review Board. To what extent, I don't know. But I think it's going to have to be very comprehensive if any changes in place that will require certain checks and balances for those participating in a Citizens Review Board.
How is morale amongst the police department after a couple months of protests and some pretty heavy scrutiny on the police department? And of course, this is something that police departments across the country are undergoing right now. But in Orlando specifically, how would you say the morale of your police force is right now?
Matthew, I would be lying to you if I told you that it has not taken a toll on the members who are out there on the front line dealing with everything that's happening, not just here, but what they're hearing and seeing across the country. There are a lot of good officers in this profession, and some feel that they've been bunched together because of the actions of others. So we will get over this. We will, and I think this is one thing I can say. The majority of the members of this profession recognize that change is needed, that we must listen. This is a time when we must listen. This is a time when we must allow our citizens to voice their concerns. But and for any officer who may be listening to this when it's aired, as it's aired, my desk right now is covered with a bunch of letters and cards from citizens who support what we're doing out there, who are very, very, very behind the great work that is being done by the officers who are doing the right thing. But like in any profession, there's always going to be someone, no matter what profession it is, there's always going to be someone who's not going to represent that profession with honor. And we, as law enforcement officers, need to be mindful of the fact that we don't need anyone who doesn't do that in our profession.
Orlando Roland is the Chief of Police in the City of Orlando. Thank you so much for joining us, Chief.
Thank you for having me.
After the break, I'll talk to activist and journalist TJ Legacy Cole about the changes he wants to see in the police department. Stay with us. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. The last few months have brought together veteran activists and people newly motivated to join protests over racial inequality and police brutality. I talked to Orlando journalist and activist TJ Legacy Cole about what the protests look like from his perspective. We talked about police reform, the Black Lives Matter mural in downtown Orlando, and his conversation with Congresswoman Val Demings, who was a guest on his podcast, The Soapbox.
You know, it's been a great it's been a great opportunity for those who have not, who don't do the work of social justice every day to, it's been great to see their enlightenment, to see what's going on, not only on the national level with social justice, but in the wake of the murders of Breonna Taylor and George Floyd. We've been doing a lot of work here locally, even before, during the pandemic and before the pandemic. So, you know, it's always great for us to get more people who want to be involved. And so the more people who are on the street who want to see a change and see police reform and accountability, the better for us. And I think it puts more pressure on those in power to make that change.
What do you make of the announcement this week that the Orlando Police Department says it's committed to banning chokeholds and no-knock warrants? Does that sort of resonate with you?
Well, it does resonate. I think the no-knock warrant, I preface everything at almost like it's a car. So we have a long road to go when it comes to police reform and police accountability. So yesterday, the car, they turned the key in the ignition, the car was rolling, but they still have their brake on it this foot on the brake. I really feel like, the no-knock warrant is a good policy. However, the ban on the chokeholds, we're still leaving it up to officer discretion. If an officer says, hey, I feared for my life, then they can use a chokehold. And we see with the Eric Gardners, they had in New York, they had a ban on chokeholds and he still was murdered. Eric Gardner still was murdered. And that officer, it took years to get that officer off of the force. So it seems a bit cosmetic to me. And Orlando continues to try to put Band-Aids on gash wounds instead of actually going in to doing a complete diagnostic of Orlando Police Department's policies, sitting down with activists who are influential and knowledgeable about these things to make actual change.
Well, let me come back to your comment before about bringing Representative Val Demings onto your podcast to talk about the issues. First of all, I mean, she obviously was former police chief in the city of Orlando, so she brings a lot of that experience to her current role as congressperson and would also, has that perspective if she were to be the vice president. What do you make of her as a potential vice presidential candidate?
Well, I think Congresswoman Val Demings, I like her personally. However, as a vice presidential candidate, I think even she said it on my show, she said that she's still trying to figure things out. She's still kind of new to this, in as far as the political in the political game, so to speak. And I think it will be very difficult for Biden-Demings ticket with her history within law enforcement here in the city of Orlando and Joe Biden's history with the 94 crime bill. There are people, and I asked her on my show, there are people who still have questions about her Protect and Serve Act, which is, deemed as the Blue Lives Matter Act with Congresswoman Val Demings. And, there are concerns about her record as a police chief. It's been widely publicized that excessive force complaints were on a rise. She was dealt a hand of, crime rate was on a rise. So it's almost like she had to make a choice, to turn a blind eye to other civil liberties or to get the crime rate down. And I think a lot of the problems in the culture of excessive force and police misconduct kind of festered under her leadership that are still here today that we are still facing with. So I think she has the responsibility to do good as a congresswoman and to help her local district fix those problems here locally.
Last week on Intersection, I talked to Kyla Coleman, the vice chair of the Citizen Police Review Board for Orlando. One of the things she was talking about, one of the things she said that the review board really wants to see a change in was de-escalation. They want to see some significant movement made there to, have police officers commit to de-escalating situations that seem to be getting out of hand. Is that a view that you share and that, other activists have been calling for as well?
Yeah, well, I think at the core of that is just you want police officers to treat people like human beings. Now, it sounds so simple, but that goes back to the culture. If you think that because you have a badge and you have you're superior to them as a human being, that doesn't give you a right to, brutalize someone or punch him or choke them or people have their own civil liberties. So you know, de-escalation can save the city money, taxpayers money, you know, just to, you know, by treating people as a human being. Myself, I'm a licensed security officer in the state of Florida. So we're trained in de-escalations. And a lot of times when situations escalate, it's because the person who engaged them, who's a security officer, said something or did something inappropriate, which ignited a conflict that didn't need to be ignited in the first place. So it is important. However, the only way that we are going to see a change within our local police departments across this country, not just here in Orlando, is if we put in place deterrence and punishments. I think even on the national scale, you can talk about where let's have a chokehold ban, but what are the punishments? How are people going to be punished? If we, John Doe, Jane Smith, if we do something wrong, there is a punishment that's going to say, well, probably shouldn't do that because we'll get some jail time. Well, you know, if we're not punishing officers with economically, if we're not punishing officers with jail time, these problems are going to fester in local police departments and throughout the country.
If we can switch gears for a moment, and you know, the city of Orlando, one of the things that they did actually wasn't just the city and county. They got together and painted a Black Lives Matter sign on a downtown Orlando street, and you've seen this happening in cities across the country. I guess, you know, most notably up in Washington, D.C., where the mayor of D.C. was fairly outspoken, saying we want to paint the sign on the street. Now, you've been quoted in the Sentinel and other media outlets as saying, you know, this, it's all very well to paint a sign on the street, but what does it really mean? I wonder if you just kind of unpack that a little bit and talk about what that sign on the street means for you and maybe some of your misgivings about it.
Well, the Orlando mural is different from the murals across the other cities, and I'll tell you why. The Orlando mural was the city of Orlando's attempt to co-opt a grassroots movement of supporters of the Black Lives Matter. So, you know, the other murals were organically done. You know, you woke up one day and all of a sudden Black Lives Matter was painted on the street. Orlando tried to have their, that, you know, the, what I call the Negro buffer class, say that, hey, there's nothing to see here. We're working together to make significant change. And we're going to have this mural painted in Pan-African colors to represent what? That mural should have been a culmination of change policies and work. Instead, it was used to attempt to pacify the masses to say that they're, you know, oh, we're doing something. And they actually have not made any substantial change for police reform. So it's actually, the Orlando mural means nothing to local activists who are actually doing the work. It's actually a slap in the face. Yes, it's there. And it, you know, we look at it, it's almost like Mayor Buddy Dyer's art project, you know, but as far as significance to us, it doesn't have that much significance because they had children out there as day laborers who were painting it, not social distancing, no mask on, some of them, and it was 90 degree weather. So why would anybody support that mural when we see that type of imagery? You didn't see a press conference and a photo op in the other cities for the mural, but you saw that here in Orlando, and there's a reason why, because it was not an authentic gesture. It was a symbolic gesture used to pacify people. And so we use it as a symbol as we got a lot more work to do. Let's keep going, because we didn't march for paint. We marched for policy.
Well, TJ Legacy Cole, journalist and activist, you can find his podcast, The Soapbox, broadcasting every Thursday at 8 p.m. TJ, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Still to come on Intersection, a conversation with Sherry Paramore, president of Elevate Orlando, about how her organization, which mentors at-risk and low-income children and youth in Orlando, is fostering dialogue with local law enforcement. Stay with us. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Sherry Paramore says the last few months of process has offered an opportunity for real change. She's the president of Elevate Orlando, a nonprofit that mentors at-risk children and youth. Tonight, her organization is holding a listening session with young people from the program and members of law enforcement. Sherry, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
So let's talk a little bit about the nonprofit that you run. Elevate Orlando was established back in 2008, and it serves low-income and at-risk youth in Pine Hills, Paramore, and Holden Heights. So tell us a little bit more about the goals for the nonprofit, like why it was set up and what you do.
So Elevate was set up and founded by Jack McGill. He's our founder. He saw this a need to help the students at Evans. He saw that Evans was closing because of low test scores, low grades, everything. And he went in search of a program that will help change the trajectory for students. And he found this program called Colorado Uplift. And so Elevate was based off of that model, Colorado Uplift. And since then, we've had they started Elevate USA, and now it's about 12 Elevates across the country now. But it was all started to help build character development skills for our students from our urban communities and really help them have a plan for their life after high school.
How many kids go through the program each year?
So we have two numbers that we talk about. Elevate students in 8th grade through 12th grade will have Elevate as an elective. And so they will come to Elevate every day because it's a credit class. That's one of our components, is our credit classes. And we hire the teacher mentors to teach those classes. And so we have about 40 students that are in the classes every day during our regular school time. And then we go to the elementary schools once a week. And so between the 480 students in our elementary schools, it's 2,000 students weekly that we touch.
This week, you're launching something new. It's the Generations for Justice Virtual Listening Forum. Tell us a little bit about what that forum is and who's involved.
Yeah, so when, George Floyd, when that situation occurred, we got tons of phone calls from, me personally growing up in Orlando, for friends who, what are we going to do? How do we make a difference? And for me, it was about our students. So because of their backgrounds and where they live, that could have been any one of our students to experience something like that. And the students were, ready to go protest. And I didn't feel comfortable just saying, okay, go protest. And so I wanted to find a way that they could learn to do what we call old-fashioned civic engagement, a way to effectively change your community, and a safe way to do it. And one of the things I got is a lot of, phone calls from my white brothers and sisters who say, I'm praying with you, what's going on, things like that. And they, it's hard to understand if you don't walk this every day, And so we wanted to first let them know what the students go through. And so our first forum was a listening forum just around race relations. Let's come to the table. Let's talk about it. We want our students to be heard. So we selected a group of students that really served on our first panel to talk about the racism that they've experienced through life. And a lot of our donors appreciated hearing that because they really couldn't fathom that even at an early age that they've experienced these things. And so the next step was, to come back and have the students lead a forum again. This time it's around law enforcement. So that's the one that we're doing next because, we want them to be armed with the right information. What are their rights? We want them to ask questions of law enforcement. But again, we want donors to hear or our friends of Elevate to hear the types of things that our students may experience on a daily basis. So this time we'll it'll be the second phase of our listening forum.
And you've got a judge, you've got Judge Bob LeBlanc, you've got representatives from the Orlando Police Department, the Orange County Sheriff's Office, and some mentors joining the conversation as well.
Yeah, so one of the things that we realized, because Elevate, as our team members, we hire our teacher mentors to represent the students they serve. So when we look at it, we're about 50% African-American, 50% Hispanic, and we have, one or two Caucasian teachers as well. But, because they come from the same backgrounds, we had one teacher mentor who shared a story And again, it's like the people that we interact with every day would never know that, you know, we go through the same type of things that you may see on TV. And so we just want to bring it home for them. So that's why we have a teacher mentor who will share his story. And then we have our students who will speak as well. But we want them to ask questions of law enforcement. The one thing we want to do is really help build a relationship with our law enforcement and our students.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Sherry Paramore. She's the president of Elevate Orlando. It's a nonprofit in Orlando that works with low-income and at-risk youth in Pine Hills, Paramore, and Holden Heights. Is this kind of work that you've done before in terms of, you know, brokering these conversations between law enforcement and your students and the teacher mentors as well, or is this new territory for you all?
This is absolutely new territory for us. You know, Elevate was really started to help. Again, we have our 13 character qualities really to help build character, those life skills for our students to help them be successful in life. But part of training our students to be leaders is to respond to community issues and to train them to respond, you know, in a way that's effective and not and safe for them as well, but to really make change happen. And so after George Floyd incident, this was new to us, but we were getting the calls and, you know, it was, let's try it. Let's do it and see what happened. And the response has been amazing. You know, people really want to come and have a conversation about this. And this time it feels different. Like we really, you know, see change happening.
Mm-hmm. Now, listening is one thing, of course, but you want to see some action out of that, right? So what kind of actions or what sort of actual changes would you like to see develop after you wrap up the listening sessions or the listening forums?
So this one that's coming up is, you know, again, it was with law enforcement. So we want to ask questions. We want to talk about the relationship. We want to, you know, encourage them with recruiting, you know, like let them hear from the students. It may help if they see officers that look like them, you know, in their communities. And so we want to just talk about, we don't want to be political, but we want to make sure that we are expressing things that can happen or change that can happen to really improve the relationships between the African-American community and law enforcement, or let me say communities of color and law enforcement.
I wonder too, Sherry, right at this moment in time, what are you hearing from the students? What are they telling you?
Well, you know, the relationship hasn't been as good as it should have been. You know what I mean? And so the students are excited to finally voice their opinion and be heard. Because so many times, you know, they can say things and not be heard. And then you get the opposite. You get the behavior, you know, acting out and things like that. And so we're happy that we have this panel that will really allow our students to be heard. So they're excited about again for Thursday night.
Thinking about what happens from here on out, do you have some other listening forums in the works as well? Are there some that you would like to hold beyond the law enforcement one?
Yes. Yeah, so just from the very first one, we realized, you know, like our friends of Elevate took the time out to listen. We had nearly 150 links, you know, like signed up for the call, of course, families as well. So I know it was at least 150 people that participated. And, you know, and again, we got a tremendous feedback, but now like a session needs to be where, you know, like our audience kind of have, you know, we have a dialogue with the students, not just listen. We just felt like that it's been so long that we haven't been heard. Like, let's people just listen first. Like, that's the first step in coming together and being unified, is just listen and understand the challenges that are faced with our students. But now it's like after we have the first and the second one, now it's time for a dialogue to get the feedback to see how we can work through these challenges together, you know, as one community. So the next one will be like a donor or friend of Elevate student conversation. And then the last one that we know that we want to do deals with the faith community, because if you look on Sunday morning, like that's the most segregated time in America is, you know, church. But if you look at civil rights, you know, it was our white brothers and sisters who marched with the African-American preachers, you know, to make change happen. And so we need to be all at the same table working towards, you know, unity in America, especially unity in this community. And so that will be the last one that we know of, is to bring the faith community together.
Well, Sherry Paramore, president of Elevate Orlando, thank you so much for joining me.
thank you for having me. And it's a pleasure to really share the message of Elevate and the students that we support.
Support for Intersection comes from Advent Health and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And we're online at wmfe.org/intersection. When you donate right now to support WMFE, you're making all the news and information you rely on available for everyone free of charge. That service is as important today as ever, and it starts with your gift. Visit wmfe.org to make your contribution, and thanks. I'm Matthew Petty. Follow me on Twitter at Matthew_Petty. Thanks for listening.